All right, welcome to the On Par podcast here. I'm sitting down with artist Lee Wybransky. Lee, thank you for joining me today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with where the Lee Wybransky story starts. You're born in this area. Tell us a little bit about growing up in the area, and then how you got sort of down the path of artist.
Sure. Well, I was one of those kids who was always drawing from the very beginning. You know, like a lot of kids, I loved to draw in color. I just turned out to be a little bit better at it than some of the other kids. So I was, just something I did for pleasure for a long time. And then when it came time for university, I decided to pursue art in university and as a profession. And I went to Syracuse University. I'm actually from Philadelphia. So
okay.
I grew up just outside of Philadelphia, not far from Marion. And then I went up to Syracuse when I was 18 to study art. Got my BFA up there, and then after that moved into the city of Philadelphia, and I've been working as a commercial artist ever since. About 9 years ago, I moved out west, so we're now based in Flagstaff, Arizona, but, you know, I do work all around the country, and, we'll be in Paris this year for the Ryder Cup, too, so... actually, I guess you'd say I've been international for a little while because I've been working for the Open Championship over in the UK since 2012. In a Reader's Digest condensed version.
Yeah, yeah. Did you, is the path you're on now, you've obviously made the posters for all the major championships and for lots of major events. Was that the... You know, I can't imagine that was the path you saw yourself in the world of golf when you're coming out of Syracuse. You know, you moved to Philadelphia, you're working commercially. What were you doing then?
The first couple of years after college, I was doing pen and ink architectural renderings, I guess you'd say.
Mm-hmm.
Drawings of private estates and small institutions around Philadelphia, mainly on the main line there.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for a couple of years. You know, I wasn't really sure... At the time, frankly, I was thinking I'd sock away a few grand, buy a Eurail pass, and, you know, backpack Europe like a lot of kids do or used to do.
Mm-hmm.
But after working for a couple of years for myself, it kind of woke up an entrepreneurial side of me that I didn't really know about. And I had a business partner at the time, and we were trying to figure out how we could grow the business from what we were doing into something bigger. And so we brought that portfolio of black and white pen and ink drawings to a lot of the best clubs around the New York section, thinking that golf and country club members in the area love their clubhouses.
Mm-hmm.
And we could sell reproductions in addition to the original drawings. So we showed it to the best clubs in the Met section, again thinking that only the best clubs are going to be interested in commissioning art, you know.
Sure.
So Winged Foot, fortunately, was my first commission in golf. We all know the golf course, but the clubhouse is, you know, one of the great clubhouses in the country.
Sure.
And it was a pleasure to work on. And Atlantic Golf Club, just down the street,
yeah,
was my second commission. And I think fourth or fifth, I drew the National Clubhouse as well. So within half a year or so,
wow.
I had done work for some of these great, great historic venues, and next thing I knew, I was a golf artist.
Well, how long were you in the commercial business before you transferred to the art, and then how scary was that to go out on your own?
Well, I was doing the architectural drawings for a couple of years, probably 2 years, and I kind of felt like I was on my own from the very, you know, from the start.
Okay.
So there wasn't really, and you know, when you're that age, you don't really feel like you're risking much, you know.
Yeah,
you
right,
got time,
right, right.
And
sure,
you know, you got the luxury of time on your side, so I didn't feel like I was risking much. I mean, 10 years in, I had my doubts about whether I was on the right road.
Right.
I've been doing it for a long time and working for a lot of private clubs and such, but I was still yet to work for, you know, the USGA or any of the governing bodies or any of the major championships. So
mm-hmm.
At that time, that's when I had my doubts about whether or not, you know, this was something that could really work long term.
Mm-hmm.
But in the beginning, when I first got into golf and started showing my portfolio in this community, it just felt very natural, very easy.
Mm-hmm.
People were very receptive. you know, one thing you always hear about working in golf is, you know, you meet some great people. And,
absolutely.
You know, even the folks who didn't necessarily commission us to do work were often helpful in introducing us to others who did. So we were greeted warmly by everyone around the game. And I certainly have enjoyed, you know, 20 years now in, I've enjoyed the experience tremendously. It's a good group of people, by and large, to work with.
Do you play much golf?
Like most, I you know, don't play as much as I would like. It's the stock answer, right?
Yeah,
I
mean, all right.
Halfway in.
The stock answer is those who are in golf don't play golf.
Don't. If you like to play, don't get in the golf business.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
So, yeah,
exactly.
We're, especially in the Northeast, I was in Philly for a long time. But especially while I lived here, you know, you're your busiest during the season.
Sure.
I played most of my golf, you know, in the shoulder season, like early spring and mid-late fall.
Right.
I love playing in the fall, so I didn't mind that. But, you know, you'd cram it all in at the ends and the start of the season.
I take it you haven't played recently since you've been on the island. Can imagine you've been.
It's distressing to be around such good golf and not play.
I'm
used to it now. I mean, there have been years where I go over to work the British, and I'll be there for 8 days, you know, at the old course or you know, any of the great courses over there. And I don't even bring my sticks because, you know, you're gone for 2 weeks. You don't have time to, you know, it's rushing back to the family and the kids.
So. Yeah, sure. So what? How you said you, after about 10 years, you start to question the, you know, how sustainable it is in terms of what you want to do. And then you sort of got your big break, I guess you could so to speak, or some sort of break, or maybe a break into the next chapter of your life. How did that all come about?
I've had a few guardian angels, I call them, through the course of my career. You know, I haven't really had that many sort of explicit mentors, so to speak, because what I do is, you know, it's such a narrow niche kind of a endeavor that there have been a few individuals who have gone out of their way through the course of my career to help me out, you know, to introduce me to the right people or to speak well of me on my behalf. And after about, I don't know, 6 or 7 years into my work in golf, I was introduced to Mary Lopezinski, who is the director of, for a long time, I believe the title was director of merchandising for the USGA, and I think it's licensing and merchandising. Mm-hmm. But she's responsible for running all the merchandise that you see here at the U.S. Open every year. And
it's just a small little tent. I mean, they don't have a whole lot of stuff in there, right?
Yeah, we call it a pop-up Nordstrom's, you know.
It's
first
crazy.
Time I had seen one, I was just blown away. And,
right?
And many, you can tell the people who have never been to one before because they're walking around with their mouth
big
hanging
eyes.
Open.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's something else altogether, for sure. So Mary contracted us. In fact, there is a little bit of synergy for us here at Shinnecock. For about 5 years, all I did for the USGA was work with them as a logo designer. So we designed the U.S. Open logos. And the first U.S. Open logo that we designed was 2004 in Shinnecock.
Get out of
here. So the very first major championship that I was involved with was 04 here at Shinnecock. So coming back this year was a thrill. You know, it's always nice to kind of tie a bow and come full circle in your life. And
sure.
It was really, and you know, I'm a big appreciator of, as many are, the traditions and the history of the game, and Shinnecock being, you know, a founding member club of the USGA, and one of the most natural and beautiful courses. And I love the land out here in the Eastern Long Island. It's just so beautiful, you know. I mean, everybody loves it, but artistically it's, you know, it's just wonderful to be out here. So to come and paint Shinnecock for all those reasons this year was really exciting.
How long – so when you – let's talk about the posters. I mean, the posters are what you're known for in terms of in the golf world. I know you do some individual whole artwork that we can get – people can look at on LeeWybransky.com. Let's talk about the process. You know, Tiger Woods always talks about the process.
Right.
Let's talk about your process. I mean – because essentially you have to capture the essence of a golf course in a frame, whether it's 8x10 or whatever, a poster, a snapshot, right? How long does that – I'm sure you're probably better at it now. You sort of have a feel for a flow of a place. But still, how long does it take you to sort of find – what it is you're looking for after being on site?
It varies from project to project. You know, I feel like it's almost a discovery process.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things about posters that I love is they started as advertising, as
sure.
many people know. So
right.
For that reason, you don't clutter a poster picture with a lot of detail. They're not like photorealist kinds of things. I mean,
right.
At least originally, when I say originally, I mean like the 20s, 30s, and 40s. You know, these things would be on the sides of bus stations and train stations and such. And so basically, they're much bolder statements. It's more like visual communication than landscape art.
Right.
So as such, I kind of adopted and took my cues from that golden age of poster design. And when I first began working in this area, I kind of coalesced my philosophy very early on is, you know, try to identify the 2-3, maybe at most 4 main characters of the situation
mm-hmm.
and create a composition that showcases those things.
Mm-hmm.
And anything else, just try and strip it away. So I kind of try and figure out what the key elements are
mm-hmm.
and build the picture and the composition around that and not clutter it up with too much detail when possible. The process, what would I say? A good example to talk about might be Chambers Bay when I did the poster at Chambers Bay in 2015. It was a course I didn't know that much about. You know,
mm-hmm.
I knew the little backstory of mm-hmm. the quarry and all the rest, but had never been there before. So I spent 2 days or so canvassing the property. And, you know, golf-wise, one of the things that's very striking about the golf course there is the bunkering is really gnarly and fingery and, you know, has a lot of character to it. So
mm-hmm.
I was very taken with the bunkering. And then the other elements that are very apparent to any visitor are, of course, the train that runs adjacent to the golf course at,
sure.
at the edge of the land. And then you had the Puget Sound, and then you had the Olympic Mountains. So there was a wealth of opportunity, different elements to work with. So
mm-hmm.
those were the 4 things that I thought were key.
Right.
And then once I identify those things, then I basically canvas the property trying to find a view that incorporates everything in a way that looks harmonious and balanced, you know, and not forced.
Right, right.
So that's sort of it. Usually by the end of a couple of days on site, I've got my top choice, and I always submit 2 other options.
Mm-hmm.
So I generally submit 3 options to the client with 1 strong recommendation. And
mm-hmm.
I can't really think of a time that I didn't get, you know, that they didn't go with the recommendation, because typically, especially the USGA, which I've been working with the longest, they're very like-minded. You know, we usually discuss going into a project, you know, what
mm-hmm.
we think at the beginning are going to be the key elements. So, and then we'll do a lot of tweaking back and forth in the proofing process, where a lot of that early stuff, I do digital art. I create a drawing, but I create it on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we do that is it's very easy to make edits. So, you know, if they say, well,
like
we love this, but can you put the logo here instead of here? Or can you use this font instead of that font? Or, you know, can this be this color and not that color?
Right.
So those types of changes are very easily done on the computer.
You use like a software like Illustrator?
Exactly right.
Okay.
Illustrator is exactly what we use.
Okay.
The same software we use for all of our logo design work.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, we're creating imagery rather than just, you know, icons.
Right.
So we create, you know, typically there's several, you know, maybe a half a dozen to a dozen rounds of revisions just going back and forth with relatively minor changes.
Right, right.
And then once we get approval from the client on the final layout, then I put paint to paper and start the actual artwork.
Right, right. So let's talk about the actual art, the artwork itself. You have a very distinct look to your, I mean, whether you're using, and we'll get to whether, when you decide to do watercolors or acrylic, but it's all the same color palette. Is that by design, number one? Is that unusual for an artist to stay within a color palette like you have? Because there's no one's going to mistake. You know, when someone sees your poster, they know it's your poster. So just how does that, you know, how has that evolved? How did you get into that sort of spectrum of colors that you decided that was going to be your palette?
It was really interesting because although I went to, you know, to art school and got a BFA, I even spent some time as an illustration major. I never got to be I never received a ton of training in watercolor. Mm-hmm. I took, you know, color theory and 2D design and things mm-hmm. like that. But I've always been more of a drawer and a draftsman, mm-hmm. More of a composition artist than a colorist. You know, some artists
gotcha.
Are just like, you know, they're born to paint. You know, they just have a great
sure.
a great sense of color. They're very comfortable with, you know, usually these painters paint in oil because it's you know, it's they're painters who just love the paint. They love
right.
how the juicy color and the
yeah.
the thickness of the paint. I was always, you know, more of a drawer on paper. So when I first started working, after a few years of working in golf, a lot of these new clients were asking me, well, we love your black and white work, but, you know, golf courses is, you know, we'd like to see some color. Can you do something in color? So
sure.
I kind of taught myself a little bit to paint in watercolor in the manner in which I do. I can remember... I think it was Caves Valley in near Baltimore,
sure.
which has hosted, you know, Caves Valley has been one of my greatest clients, period, throughout my career. I just did another painting for them last year when they
right.
hosted the Senior Constellation.
Sure.
But they were one of my early clients, and I did a painting of a different hole for them each year for 16 years. I virtually painted every hole on the golf course for one of their regular club events. Anyways, the very first time I painted, I did their second hole, and I think I did, you know, five or six different paintings of the second hole
right.
Until I got one that I was satisfied with. And mm-hmm. In terms of colors, one of the things I decided through the course of the process I just described, doing those five paintings, was I never use green.
Right.
I don't paint with any green paint. You know, mm-hmm. I mix all my greens from different blues and different yellows, and then... you know, in painting parlance, there's an expression called dirty colors or broken colors.
Okay.
And that's where, you know, you take what's a bright color and you mix in a little bit of its opposite.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so green and red are complementary colors. So if you take a vibrant, you know, St. Paddy's Day green
right.
and you put a little red in there, it muddies it up and it makes it a little bit olive.
Sure.
So I really like, rather than like the primary colors, which are really vibrant and bold and bright,
mm-hmm.
I typically like to work with these broken colors.
Okay.
Which, you know, has the effect, which was not necessarily so deliberate, but it has the effect of creating sort of a vintage feel to the art. It looks aged or it has a patina.
Right.
So, you know, I just was drawn to that color scheme, and,
sure.
and that's the part of the color wheel that I kind of live in.
Right.
I try not to repeat colors deliberately. I mean,
right.
you don't want to just sort of play the same
note
over and over.
Right,
but.
And I didn't mean to imply that you do. No, imply that you do. I'm just saying it just seemed, but you do live in a certain parameter,
mm-hmm.
I guess, and all of it is diverse and beautiful. I didn't know if that was I'm not from that background.
Right.
I didn't know if that was something that was common for artists to do, but it seems like this is your niche, so to speak.
It's definitely become, it's an interesting balancing act you have to, or a line you walk as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to, you know, first of all, you just do what you love to do, and you do
sure.
what you're attracted to, what catches your
yeah,
eye.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, if you get it, if you're lucky enough to find an audience that enjoys that
yeah.
work, then, you know, that's great. And then you kind of become known for a certain look or a certain
yeah.
feel. But artistically, you know, you don't like to just repeat yourself. You
yeah.
know, you have to keep stretching, I feel like, or the work becomes stale. So
right.
You need to do it not only for your audience, but just to keep yourself interested and engaged. You
sure.
know, you need to feel like you're trying new things all the time.
Right.
So, you know, while you yet at the same time, if you start doing going too far afield, you run the risk of losing your audience,
sure,
you know, and,
sure.
and people come to look for a certain, you know, type of product, quote unquote, from you. So
sure.
It's been an interesting thing. Now that I've been doing this for a good while now, you know, this is my 12th U.S. Open poster.
Mm-hmm.
I've been working for 20 years, but I feel like as a poster artist, you know, my first was in this general neighborhood, and, you know, speaking nationally, but my first poster was the 2001 Senior PGA Championship at Ridgewood.
Right.
And it's still one of my favorites. But even at that very beginning, I feel like my colors kind of shone through there, and I've kind of, you know, to a certain extent, have created a very identifiable color palette. that I think is recognizable throughout my work. Every now and then I do things brighter, you know, especially like, for example, like Torrey Pines, the first U.S. Open I did. I feel like, you know, it's not like, you know, I don't know what you'd say, nautical colors, like super bright.
Right.
But,
right,
you know, the U.S. Open was coming to Southern California for the first time in 50 years, and I wanted to have a Southern California color,
right.
You know,
yeah,
so
yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It, you know, I deliberately made that a little bit brighter because I just felt like the light out there and the location and the cultural milieu there was, you know, different than it is in the Northeast, which
sure.
is a little bit more buttoned up.
Yeah, right. A little more kickback, a little
exactly.
SoCal.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, that's cool. When you talked about learning to be a colorist, so to speak, how much did you enjoy that process? Did you learn anything a little bit about yourself when you were doing that?
You know, it's I definitely learned about myself in terms of developing a process that works for me and works mm-hmm. for this genre or this niche. Part of the reason watercolor is a very unforgiving media,
right?
Medium, so. You can't, you know, you can only add, you can't subtract in watercolor, you know.
Right.
If you make a mistake, you can't cover it up. You can just, like, try and make it blend in, so to speak. So,
right.
I, you know, as a commercial artist, I don't really have the time to spend 3 days on a painting only to discover that I don't like it and throw it away and start all over again, you know.
Right.
It's a deadline business, and things need to be done on time. So there's not a lot of time for... you know, I don't want to call them failures, but, you know, the like crippling mistakes, you
right,
know. So
right.
so I developed a process that's a little bit methodical in the sense that I build up, because you can never go dark to light with watercolor. You can only, you know,
go
you can
light,
only go light
to
dark.
Right.
So as a consequence of that, you know, I work in sort of, you might say, baby steps, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I build the colors up slowly. I mean, I obviously have my ideas about what colors, you know, how dark, how light. You know, how blue I want the sky to be.
Sure.
But I build the colors up slowly by a lot of layers of glazing where you just lay thin wash over thin wash. And the colors, as a result, become – I feel like that's one of the other things that my work – it's not talked about as much, but watercolor is transparent. And
right.
the more colors you lay on top of each other, rather than mixing colors together in the paint box and then
right.
putting them on the paper – you mix one color, you put one color down, and then you lay a thin wash of the other color on top of it, and it creates a more luminous effect where, you know, the light goes in and it bounces back off the white paper beneath, and your eye kind of mixes. Like if it's a green and I lay down a yellow and a blue separately, your eye creates the green. It's not like you're mixing yellow and blue paint on a box and then putting it on the thing.
And
so it has a very different effect, and it's you know, you can achieve more luminous, bright light effects that way. And you can do this with oil as well, but oil, you can do a lot more different things.
Right.
You can work oil this way, but watercolor right. kind of only works this way because it's a transparent paint. It's not really an opaque paint.
Right.
So, you know, and I build the colors up slowly, and that helps give, like, the light kind of comes from within a little bit.
How long – that sounds like a complicated process, something that you'd have to, you know, and obviously, like you said, you have to be kind of careful. And I would also think that with that kind of technique and that medium – then I would say that since it's so light dependent, that picture could look totally different in a different light wherever you put it. So like that picture might reveal some things more in one light and then others in another light. It's almost like a picture you would want to move around the house at different times just because it would evolve in the different kind of light.
It changes. You're absolutely right. It changes a lot depending on the light. And to be fair, I mean, art in general, especially paintings, but photos too, if it's color anyway,
mm-hmm.
You know, so much of the effect of the work or the impact of the work is affected by the light that's on it.
Right.
Whether it's daylight, whether it's, you know, a yellow or, a blue fluorescent light in an office
sure.
or a warm yellow light in a living room. I mean, the painting will change drastically depending upon what kind of light it's being viewed in.
Right.
You know, when I'm painting, I paint in you know, artificial daylight,
right.
which is, you know, sort of a neutral because I feel like that adapts best. You know, you wouldn't
sure.
want to paint a painting in like warm yellow light, and then you take it outside, and it's like, oh my God, you don't even recognize it. You know?
Exactly.
Or it goes in an office where it's under the exact opposite kind of light, and even more so, you know. So
which brings me to the setup then in your studio then, because you're saying an artificial daylight, which means, and for people who don't realize, you're talking about it's not just one light. You probably have several lights, right, sort of around you, whether it's a bounce card or whatever, however you achieve. But, you know, it can't be – it's not just like a light bulb on the top of your ceiling that, you know, one hi-hat that's sort of lighting your room. Talk about how do you achieve that, because that's not what, as easy as some people might think it is.
I have a couple of lights. I work with, you know, fairly traditional. They probably even make, you know – as much as I love to utilize technology, I'm also sort of I like old things too. Anyway,
yeah.
I've got a couple of old lights that I've had forever, and they are each I have one on either side of me at my drafting table. The thing about watercolors, you don't paint on an easel very much in watercolor, mm-hmm. you know, because what happens is it needs to be on about a 45-degree incline.
Right.
Because you use gravity when you paint in watercolor.
Oh,
like, wow. You lay the paint down. Like, when I'm painting the sky, you paint by putting one stroke over another stroke over another stroke, and you work your way down the paper.
Oh, that's
so gravity literally pulls the paint down the paper as it's on this gentle 45-degree incline. If you're painting from life and the paint paper is almost vertical,
right,
when you put that in, the tendency is the paint's just going to run and drips,
sure,
like straight down the picture.
Of course.
And if you're working flat, it doesn't run anywhere. It just sits where you put it. So you always work on a slight incline. And I have a beautiful antique drafting table that I've had for many years in my studio. And I've got two massive lights on either side. And each light contains two bulbs, a central bulb, which is neutral and a little bit warm. It's more like a floodlight kind of.
Uh-huh.
And then there's a circular halogen around it, which is a little bit cooler. So you use both lights together to create this, synthetic daylight, which is more neutral. And I just have two lights because, you know, I'm getting older and my eyes are going, and I need a lot more light than I used
to. Now, are those lights both white or like a white, or do you have – or would it make sense to have one that's a little cooler and a little one a little warmer?
That's
and have
exactly
them
what it is. One's a little cooler, one's a little warmer, and then they create.
Right. So for people listening, cooler, I mean, it's a more in the bluish tone, and then for the warmer one, it's more in the orange tone. So together, you get that artificial light.
Exactly right.
We talked a little bit about the watercolor. You do also stuff in acrylic. How much is that? How different is that? You know, what kind of process is that for you? And what kind of challenge does that present other than as opposed to the watercolor?
It's a lot of, it's a lot of fun to work in acrylic, kind of like just because it's out of the norm, you know. It's more a novelty to it. And as such, I feel a little freed up when I work with it. And it's also a much more forgiving medium because, you know, you can cover up mistakes or you can just wipe them off and start again. Acrylic is probably the most versatile medium. I just don't particularly love it because it's plastic at the end of the day. You know, it dries to a plastic.
And
it doesn't – it's lifeless in that regard. So I use it when we're seeking to create unique textures that are impossible to create with oil or with any other paint.
Right.
So that is one of the neat things about acrylic is you can mix certain things into it to give it more body or to make it stiffer or things like that. So generally, when I work with acrylic, we've done some abstractions in the studio where it's more about texture and surface,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
less about, you know, representation,
right.
and less about, you know, light effects.
Sure. I love the way you describe that as lifeless. I mean, obviously, as an artist, you have certain sensibilities, and being that you work outside and you're, you know, more of a landscape artist in the sense
of,
you know, so natural things of nature and a naturalness to them, if you will, appeal to you as opposed to a cold, hard plastic.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's very similar. I I use a lot of golf metaphors, probably right. too many when I'm describing the work, because lots of times I'm talking to people who know golf and don't know art.
Right.
But, you know, you can't putt well if you don't like the look of the putter when you're standing over it.
Right,
you know?
Right,
and it's
right.
like that. Like, you know, another artist can create tremendous effects with
sure.
acrylic paint.
Sure.
And they may love it. But to my sensibility and my aesthetic, the way I approach things, I love oil and I love watercolor because they're age old. You mm-hmm. know, they're centuries old. They're usually some sort of a natural pigment.
Mm-hmm.
Natural materials made, you know, made into paint rather than, you know, a 60-year-old synthetic chemical equation.
To use your metaphor, they're like the Core and Crenshaw of mediums, right? They like the natural, rugged, sort of aged look as opposed to the manufactured, you know, laser cut lines of some yeah. modern golf courses.
It's fair. It's a fair analogy, I'd say.
All right. Two more things. I want to talk about some local activity you have here. But before we get there, I want to talk about that little thing you did for Scratch TV when you were doing the painting live on the 16th hole or 17th 16th hole at TPC in Arizona there, and for the waste management. Just talk about that process as you incorporated, because you know that's live, number one. You got guys coming in to set the stage for the people listening. Lee was basically set up with an easel on the tee box in that pandemonium. And golfers were just coming up as you were painting the scene, the green and the stadium, and golfers were coming up and putting in their two cents, so to speak,
right.
as you gave them a thing. That must have been crazy.
It was really, really fun. You know,
yeah.
most of the work that I do is in my studio.
And it's in your
head,
right?
Isolation and
in your own
half
head.
The time I've got headphones on and I'm just kind of, you know, by myself. I mean, I have a lot of me time when I'm busy.
Well, I was just going to say, like, because you spend so much time in your head when you're painting,
mm-hmm.
and then you were sort of flooded with all this external inspiration. It had to feel quite a not a shock to your system, but certainly as an artist, it's certainly a little bit of a shock.
Absolutely, and the only reason it was not too much of a shock was because I was so excited for the opportunity to do it. I mean,
right.
I've always felt I probably had teachers in college who instilled this, but you know, anytime you get too comfortable as an artist, it's usually to the detriment of your work.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
So you got to push yourself out of your comfort zone now and then.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of, you know, Scratch. We cooked up this idea with Scratch and. They were great to work with, but in terms of the experience itself, I mean, I've painted around people before, but I've never painted, you know, in the center of like a stadium environment like that.
And that's not just a average, normal bunch of people
right.
either. You know, let's be fair.
It's a well-lubricated crowd, that's for sure.
Exactly, exactly.
But, and I've never had a situation where I've invited other people to just come up and start, you know,
drawing
paint,
stick
you know,
figures
yeah,
in the
start,
middle of your
exactly.
masterpiece there.
But it was so much fun. And, you know, part of it was, well, we knew it was going to be one sitting, you know.
Right,
so
right.
you can't get too uptight about it, you know,
no,
meaning like
no.
you're going to paint for 6 hours and it's going to be what it's going to be. So it's more about the process than the result at that point, you know. So I just figured, you know, I'm just going to jump in and roll with it, and we'll see what comes of it.
Anybody can hit a fastball. Two can hit the curveball.
Right?
Right. And that's what that experience is. It's just one giant curveball. So who, before we get to your local stuff, just last thing, who made, if you remember, because it was a bit ago, what golfer made the most significant contribution to the piece? If you
well, I guess there were a few, you know. We had a few. I had a few thoughts in mind, you know. Russell Knox, whom I
sure.
love, I love him. We've met a few times over at the Open overseas, and mm-hmm. a super cool guy. And he came in, and you know, a lot of the guys are very self-deprecating,
yeah,
almost
yeah.
anxious, or you know, a little bit like I don't want to mess
oh,
it up.
When
you
I
know,
when you watch the piece, if you look at Justin Thomas, he's like he was like a little
right.
frozen almost. Like he was like, oh man, I'm not really good at that. Like
right.
it was like
yeah, yeah. I mean, they're it's funny because it's out of their comfort zone too.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean? So, but Russell came in and just you know, I decided to use mostly palette knives to paint that painting.
Sure.
Which, for people who don't know, it's like painting with a small spatula instead of a brush, you know. So the idea was you
looks like you were going to do like icing on a cake.
Exactly.
Almost. Yeah.
So you use more paint, and you can't be too uptight with it. Like, it's kind of impossible. It's like it's inherently a little bit messy, and which forces you to be a little bit loose and less serious, you know. So,
sure.
So I did that on purpose, and you know, a couple of the guys were really like, you know, very nervous almost about it, as you mentioned. But, you know, I never thought about this before, but I feel like Europeans in general, art is more a part of people's day-to-day life in Europe, you know, than it is here in America.
Yeah.
Here it's more of like a novelty, something you go to a museum or something to do.
Right.
You know, in Europe, people live with it. You know, it's in their houses, and it's just a little bit more common part
more,
of life.
It's more culturally ingrained.
Yeah, it's well said.
You know,
so Russell came over, and he was like, you know, he wasn't nervous at all. He's like, all right, what do you want me to do? I was like, well, you can do whatever you want, but, you know, I got this lovely blue here mixed up. You know, you're Scottish. That's about the color of your flag. So he just took it right up there and started moving it around and working it into the sky. And he was like, you know, completely just jumped right in.
At ease.
So, you know, it was different blue than the rest of the sky, but I thought I left that in there because I just liked the way he was very comfortable with it. We had, for Bubba, naturally, we had a bunch
paint,
of pink
paint
mixed up. So
he
was very cool about it, too. He came over and picked up the brush and just started making little pink dots in the grandstand. And he's like, yeah, this is all my fans and family right here. So
that's pretty funny.
He did a great job with that pink and trying to think. I think Billy Horschel I couldn't believe that he was the first, because he was about the eighth or ninth guy who contributed, but he was the first guy to do a stick figure.
Okay,
because I thought we would have had a lot of stick figures
in
there.
Right.
But he painted a little stick figure into the stand. So those were probably the ones that come to mind.
Right. Let's talk about golfing art of Lee Wybranski. It's something that you got going on here at the Southampton Cultural Center from June 7th to June 30th. You know, tell us a little more about it.
Yeah, I'm thrilled about this. I mean, we kind of thought of it as a mid-career retrospective. I mean, I'm 20 years in, and I've done a lot of work. And what's interesting about my work is while it hangs in, like, you know, thousands and thousands of homes around the world now, most people only see the work in reproduction.
Right.
They only see posters or prints of the work, and very rarely
like the ones you're signing here.
Exactly. You know, we'll sign and sell thousands of posters here at Shinnecock, and the posters are beautiful. I'm particularly pleased with this year's. Tried to change up the palette a little bit because for reasons we could go into later, but I definitely tried to bring some new colors. I used some new paints for this picture because I wanted to sort of stretch. But anyways, no one really gets to see the originals, and we had a lot of them in the drawers. A lot of my work, the product is the reproduction. It's, you know, so the originals are often retained by me.
Mm-hmm.
And we had met with the Cultural Center when I was out here doing my field work for the poster last August, and there was an interesting opportunity to have an exhibit that coincided with the U.S. Open here at Shinnecock. And, you know, given the location here in the Hamptons, I thought it was an appropriate venue. You know, people with a certain level of sophistication and interest in the arts, as well as disposable income. So we have 48 original pieces of mine on display for the month of June. And, you know, the originals in general, they're richer, they're more vibrant than the reproductions by and large. So it's a chance for people to see some of my greatest hits in a form that, you know, they won't really ever get to see otherwise. So I could rattle off so many favorites, but this year's painting for Shinnecock Hills is there. It's obviously the centerpiece of the show.
I actually would like to see the one you did for Torrey Pines, because you said you had made it vibrant.
Yeah.
So I can imagine it really pops.
That one, unfortunately, sits in Torrey Pines. So
that was not part
of the show.
Oh.
You know, I typically seek to sell the original artwork to the club or to the champion, and Torrey owns that piece. So we were not able to secure
retain that
on loan.
Well, but that's all right.
There's Shinnecock. There's the piece I did for Pinehurst. There's a number of other USGA venues I've done for other events, such as Women's Opens, Senior Opens, etc. The poster or the painting I did for the 18th. I mean, if you're in my business, and when you get to paint the old course at St. Andrews, you kind of feel like you've arrived. You know?
Yeah, sure.
And I've had the chance to paint it a few times, but probably the most exciting opportunity was the 2015 Open.
Sure.
And I painted, you know, the 18th, the finishing hole at St. Andrews. Typically, you know, the paintings I do of a golf course are, you know, with no people, no grandstands, no fanfare. It's just, you know, the course itself, which I seek to make iconic. Mm-hmm. But in this case, we decided we would present the course in full open regalia, you know, so the big yellow scoreboards,
awesome.
The massive grandstands set
sure.
against, you know, the R&A Clubhouse and Hamilton Hall and Roussock's. So it just is one of my very favorites. That one's in there.
I look forward to seeing that.
The piece I did for the Ryder Cup at Hazeltine is there, which is another you know, more recent favorite. There's mm-hmm. just a couple of old gems, you know, little
sure.
tiny pieces. There's a painting of Atlantic Golf Club that I did probably in 1998, 99, something like that, a small little watercolor. One of the par threes out there that's just another little favorite of mine. So
yeah, yeah.
Little studies, you know, they're not all finished pieces. You know, a lot of the work, the studies aren't always nice, you know, because you do these preparatory sketches for the bigger paintings just to sort of work out your color ideas in mm-hmm. advance. They're typically done in a few hours, you know, and they're, you know, sometimes they're a little messy. There might be spots or, you know, because they're not intended to be.
Right.
Finished works, but every once in a while, one of those turns into something special.
Right.
So there's a good half a dozen different studies that we included in there
right.
That are just delightful. And, you know, so I just would love for people to come out and see it. You know, a lot of the work is available for purchase, but mainly I just wanted to showcase this work that, you know, has sort of sat in our studio for a little while. And,
sure.
And I wanted to just get people in there to have a look at it, and I invite people to come and enjoy it and,
so
you know, reach out online and social media and let me know what you think.
So it's the Southampton Cultural Center and in Southampton, obviously, and it runs to June 30th, so just a few more days on that. I'm just trying to think of, like, what would be your – when now that the Open – when the Open's over – when will you be there? When can people meet you and talk to you about your piece?
Regrettably, I'll be returning back to Arizona on Monday. You know, this is, I don't know, something like day 11 for me here.
It's
been a long stint. We had the reception last Saturday,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately. I wish it was this weekend,
yeah,
so we could have talked about it. But
yeah.
We had an artist reception last Saturday. And it was great. It was, you know, very well attended. The mayor of Southampton turned out, as well as some of the local media and writers that I've worked with in the last few weeks. And a lot of friends from the Open were out as well, some USGA folks. So, you know, that was the chance, really, to meet me. We tried to put the word out as much as we could, and it was, as I said, well attended. But, you know, I'm at Lee Wybransky on Twitter is always a good way. And
yeah.
I would love to hear what people think. So
absolutely.
And if anyone has questions, you know, I'm on Facebook and Insta and Twitter. So if anyone has questions about the work that they'd like to ask, they're certainly invited to reach out on social media and we'll be prompt with a reply.
I'm definitely going to go and check this out.
Great.
At Southampton Cultural Center in Southampton, New York. But I'm going to wait until the Open is over so that the traffic is a little lighter. It's been a little crazy.
It's been rough.
I've
done a lot of these, and I've never had so much trouble getting access. But,
yeah.
You know, we knew that coming in.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Listen, the growth in the area has just been, you know, it's really growing. Let's just put it
yeah.
that way. And so it's definitely put a little bit of a chokehold on the situation here, but they've made some, they've definitely made some changes in the last couple of days. So hopefully it's going to alleviate a little bit. And I know
on the plus side, you know, there's a little joke amongst our U.S. Open vendors and, you know, compadres about, you know, the historic courses are always in the east, but the good weather is always in the west.
Yeah, exactly.
But this year, I feel like, you know, this is about as good as you could hope for. I mean, the weather's been largely spectacular. It's looking like a beautiful weekend. The course is, I mean, it's amazing. John Jennings, who's the superintendent here, as I'm
yeah.
sure you know,
yeah.
friend of mine, he actually hosted me when I was out here last August.
Oh, okay.
Doing the field work for the project. And the course is just, it just looks like, I mean, it's magical.
Yep.
So it's people who are here this weekend are going to be very, very happy.
They're going to be in for a real treat.
Yeah.
Well, Lee Wybranski, thank you for joining me on the On Par podcast here. I really appreciate your time. I know you're busy, but really fascinating stuff to get a little peek behind the curtain to further understand what you do.
I appreciate your interest, and thanks for having me. And it's been a lot of fun. Hopefully we can do it again sometime down the road.
Oh, absolutely. The next major venue will be a nice little catching up. All right, that's it from this edition of the On Par podcast. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. Have a great day.